This is a continuation of the interview with Russell Schneider. Today is the 3rd of September 2015. We're continuing the interview at the museum in Canberra here. We finished the last session late 1978. We were up to, you know, Fraser, Sapt, Withers. But I'm wondering, to begin today, were you able to listen to the last session we recorded? I sent you the CD. And is there anything you'd like to add or elaborate upon or correct even, you know, any factual type errors?
Thanks, Baron. Well, I have listened to it, and I noticed a number of times my memory failed me in respect of things like dates and names of committees and things like that. But I think basically anyone who might be looking at it would be able to correct those. So the official, if there's any variation between the date or the name and the official history, I'd suggest people rely on the official history rather than my faulty memory. And the one thing that I couldn't go through them all, but one that I did remember was, I think this is my one. I talked about Gough going overseas in December 1975. Of course, I meant December 1974. There's a few little things like that where I just couldn't remember the precise date.
And they're kind of self-evident mistakes.
I think so, yeah. And as I said, if you compare it with the official history, I'd rely on the official histories.
And anyone interested in this would have a... presumably would have a background in that period of politics. Yeah. There were a couple of points I wanted to ask about in light of the email you sent me. You mentioned a few things that you were keen to talk about. Let's take them one by one. There was somebody by the name of Les Love. Can you tell me about Les, who he was and why he's memorable?
Well, Les Love was an older journalist in the gallery. He was probably one of the oldest people in the press gallery in those days. He'd been here for a long, long time. I don't think anyone knew exactly how long. And I said it that I specialised in reporting the Senate, but Les was even more a specialist in reporting the Senate than I. He was almost a permanent fixture in the gallery, in the Senate press gallery, from the time I arrived, for years and years until he retired or died. Les, we became known to all and sundry as Senator Love, partly because he spent so much time. Les was the only person I know of who was certainly the only journalist who was allowed to interject, and he couldn't stand pomposity or hubris or anything like that. And so the moment he detected that taking place on the floor of the Senate, he'd immediately proceed interjecting, which the precedents or the chair of committees would accept these interjections coming down from the on high. And from time to time, the senators had actually replied to these interjections that were coming from Les. So he was quite a character. He kept very, very much to himself. He didn't particularly socialise with the other journalists or anything like that, but he was quite a Senate institution. And he was a very nice man, apart from anything else. So,
that's amazing that he wasn't reprimanded.
Well, I think he'd been there for so long, and I think probably his interjections were so pertinent that a lot of people on the floor of the chamber wished that they'd thought about them themselves.
And look, the other one that you mentioned in the email was the Bass by-election. That's 1975, isn't it, when Lance Barnard is retired and...
Yes.
There's a huge swing against Labor in that election, but...
That was the time when people became certain that Labor was going to lose the election, and it happened pretty much in the middle of winter, and Launceston in Tasmania is a pretty cold place at the best of times, and in the middle of winter you can feel the wet, you can feel the damp coming up through the soles of your feet until it works its way up to your head. And I was working with Withers at that stage, and we went down to Bass to campaign with Fraser, and I vividly recall on one occasion we had a Commonwealth car that was given to Malcolm. We didn't have a Commonwealth car ourselves, and he insisted we travel with him from one point to another. So bundled into this car were Fraser, Withers, both of them quite large men, myself, Ridge's private secretary, Rob Maher, and Fraser's private secretary, and David Barnetti's press secretary. So you can imagine this car, big though it was, was like a can of sardine sort of pressed together. And Malcolm thought it was so funny. But anyway, on the day of the by-election itself, Ridge was sent around the booths to, as were all the shadow ministers and ministers from the government side, to just sort of encourage the booth workers to keep on handing out vote cards. And we got to one place that was, and it was a not just bitterly cold, it was a really, really cold day, and it was raining. And we arrived at this place, and the rain had sort of stalled a little bit, but was still sprinkling. And Ridge went over to the Liberal Party workers and chatted with them, and I was stood in the background a little bit. And then a man came over to me, and he was wrapped up in, literally wrapped up in newspapers. He had newspapers strapped around his legs and his arms, held on with elastic bands. And he said, look, excuse me, sonny, because I was a bit younger than him. He said, would you do me a favour? Oh, yeah, I said, what? He said, well, I'd like you to hand out these how to vote cards for me. And I looked at him and I realised that they were how to vote, Labour, how to vote cards. And I said, oh, look, I've Senator Withers over there and he's from the other side. And this guy said, look, he said, don't worry about it. He said, my problem is I've been here, I've never ever, no, he said, I've been a member of the party all my life, and I've never ever missed a polling day where I haven't been here to hand out how to vote cards with all the others. But this time I'm the only one here. I came here at, when the booths opened, and I've been here ever since, and quite frankly, I need to go to the toilet, which is just out the back, so it'll only be a couple of minutes. I said, well, yeah, but he said, look, don't worry, son, no one's going to take him. And he was absolutely right. I stood there with the Labor Party. I said to Withers, can I do this? He said, yeah, do it for the poor old man. And so I did, and literally people just walked past and they did not want to know. And you could tell from the vibe there, because it looked as though it was probably a reasonable sort of Labor booth. So that was a very telling experience.
The only time you've handed out Labour cards. Gee, yeah, that's... yeah, well, there was that huge swing, wasn't there? About 16%, and it had been a very safe Labour Party electorate.
It was a massive swing. And, of course, I mean, the first thing that went wrong... Well, firstly, the government was in bad odour. Secondly, Lance Barnard had held the seat for a very long time. And I think people were a little offended that he was giving the seat up and taking an ambassadorship. And thirdly, Labor picked a very bad candidate, a dud candidate. And so those three things together, I think, just multiplied the swing. They would have lost the seat in any circumstances, I suspect. But those three things just made it massive. And that, of course, gave the Liberal Party much more, or the coalition, much more confidence that it was going to win the next election and help them tough it out, which reminds me of one of the other things I did forget when I noticed I was saying the then opposition was very, very determined to do all sorts of things. But within that, there was also a lot of concern, which went right up to the top. Fraser himself was very, very concerned from time to time about whether the course he'd embarked on was the wise course or the wrong course. And I vividly remember one night, late one night, when the opposition had had a very bad day in Parliament, walking past the House of Reps opposition leader's office, that is Malcolm Fraser's office, and I looked in, the door was open, and Dale Budd and his private secretary and David Barnett, his press secretary, were in conversation, but they also looked extremely agitated, concerned and worried. And so I walked in there and I said, look, guys, I think the first thing you should do is shut the door so no one can see you. And secondly, if people do see you, you shouldn't be looking as concerned as you are, because the whole key to this operation, for what it's worth, is confidence. And if we don't look as though we're confident in what we're doing, that's going to seep through to our own people, it's going to seep through to the media, and it'll seep through to the public. So although there was a sort of determination to keep on plugging away, that didn't mean that people weren't extremely concerned about the potential risk that they faced. And the risk they faced, of course, was electoral annihilation. If there had been an election and the electorate had not supported the coalition, obviously Fraser's own position would have been impossible. So there were high stakes.
Well, thanks for that. The other point you mentioned in the email related to the Senate Committee on Securities and Exchanges and Lionel Murphy, and I'm wondering, but before we talk about that one, I wanted to ask something that you mentioned when we walked into the building today. And you said you'd been up to the press gallery.
Right, yes.
What was that like for you going back? What memories did it bring back of the working situation in that gallery?
Well, I was surprised, delighted, and disappointed, to be quite honest. Three things. The disappointment was that the gallery has shrunk from what it actually was. I guess for whatever reasons they've cut back the size of the gallery, rather than, I think at one stage they were going to demolish the whole thing, but they've retained a section of it, but it's a very, very old section. I was surprised to see, however, that the heart of the gallery, I suppose you'd call it, was intact. That is where the press pigeonholes or boxes were kept, which is where all the news came out. And there were lots and lots of quite big news stories came out there. As I mentioned before, this was the period of Vietnam, and the first news the Australian people got of what was going on in Vietnam would usually come through the gallery press boxes, where the Department of Defence or the Department of Army would issue a press release, which was usually very bland, to the effect of there was a contact in somewhere in Vietnam today, and several members of the Australian contingent were wounded or killed or whatever it might be. Names will be announced later, that sort of thing. And so, of course, we'd get on to Army PR, which would sometimes background us with a little bit of detail about what had actually taken place, so that we could file a story. But it was quite a strange experience, actually. You know, we were thousands and thousands of miles away from the conflict, and yet we were getting the first news, sometimes possibly getting the news before the troops in Phung Tau received it, about what was happening with Australian troops there. And a friend of mine who had been at Vietnam said later, talking about Afghanistan actually, we really do our servicemen and women a great disservice by not letting people know more about the actual circumstances in which they find themselves, and more detail about the battles and the confrontations and so on that they have, because it seems so far away, so remote, and the only news we ever receive is bad news about people being killed or wounded. And I think he's probably right, that there'd be a lot more understanding and possibly a lot more sympathy for the diggers that do go and put their lives on the line from time to time. But that was one of the things that came through. The other thing that was quite fascinating was, again, space exploration, because we've got the big space stations out at, or space aerials, out at Tidbinbilla. And much of the news about the moon flights came through from there and was translated into the boxes. And at one stage they had, I think, I think it was when the first moon landing took place, they rigged up a speaker system at the press gallery boxes so that you could hear the exchanges taking place between the astronauts, NASA, and our ground stations here in the ACT. And then one night there was a bit of space junk was going to come and descend on Australia somewhere, and it happened to be at a time when there was a postal strike, so all telecommunication strike, so all the telecommunications were down, and we had retained one line from Canberra to Sydney, and it went. And of course, the news about where this bit of space junk was going to land was coming out of Canberra. And the editor of the Daily Telegraph and the Australian, they kept the paper open until they could get this news of what was going on. Finally, a decision. There were no phones. We didn't have a phone hookup. The only communication we had was this teleprint line, which I said had dropped out, and a statement came out saying that the bit of space debris was going to land in, I think, in the middle of the West Australian desert, so no one was going to be injured or anything like that. We had to get that news up to Sydney so that they could close the paper. So we had, although we didn't have the teleprint line, we still had a telex line that was open. Wouldn't communicate within Australia, but I ended up sending a telex to our office in New York, which bounced it over to our office in London, which had a direct teleprinter line to Sydney that was still open, and they got the message there. So it went from Canberra, New York, London, Sydney. One of the longest distance news stories of all time. I said I was delighted. I was delighted and surprised to see that my old office, when I went back to the News Limited the second time, is actually one of the offices that are on display in the gallery. And opposite it was what was at that time our teleprinter room and library, but had been the Australian Associated Press office where the co-opted journalists from the Sydney Morning Herald, Daily Telegraph and so on worked when Parliament was sitting. And so there was something like seven people working in that small room and that included one person who was a teleprinter operator. So you had the teleprinter going virtually all day, and journalists would be coming in and out of the press gallery writing what had been taking place in Parliament. And at the end of question time, you may well have six people plus the teleprinter operator all pounding away at typewriters. And you can imagine the sort of noise that was taking place in there. Plus we had speakers on in both houses of Parliament, so you could listen to what was going on in the House of Reps and the Senate at the same time, which talk about sort of juggling things around, or multitasking. That was real multitasking. And then my office was the one opposite it, where they've got a fairly large display. We had three people working in that room, myself, chief of staff, and one other person on another desk. And so the whole place was pretty cramped, and people were literally working cheek by jowl.
And was there smoking permitted back
then?
Oh,
yes. Yes, you'd walk in there and there'd be this haze of smoke, sort of about from about a metre above floor level, there was just this cloud. And it was very, very hard work and hard living, I think, is the way to describe it.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to say about that before we move on?
I don't think, well, well, one other memory, just in case I forget it later, is in the corridor that separates those two offices I talked about, that was the site of the Press Gallery cricket games. We didn't play them out on the oval or outside in those days. It was played inside Parliament House. And it's about 20 metres or so long. And so someone had set up bat and ball, or set up with their bat just next to the boxes, and someone down at what was the ABC office had proceeded to bowl a ball down through the gallery. It was one way of filling in time when things were quiet.
All right, well, shall we move on now and talk about the that other point that you mentioned in your email about Senator Murphy and the Senate Committee on Securities and Exchanges?
I think that was the Committee on Securities and Exchange was probably the first major step in the Senate really asserting its powers of inquiry, and which I think had probably been corrupted a little bit as time's gone by. But as I said earlier, Lionel Murphy was quite determined to use the Senate as a political weapon, because if he could get the DLP on side, he could pass resolutions, motions, and set up committees and inquiries. And so there'd been a fairly spectacular stock market crash. I can't remember the exact date, but it would have been in the late 60s, involving minerals exploration companies, basically. And Murphy decided to try and extract as much political capital out of that as he could. So he moved for the establishment of a committee to inquire into, it was called the Senate Select Committee on Securities and Exchange. And it was intended to be basically a short, sharp bash over the head of the Liberals and their stock market colleagues and big business and capitalism and everything like that. What they didn't allow for was the coalition appointed Magnus Cormack to chair the committee, and Peter Ray from Tasmania was appointed sort of chief counsel, or counsel assisting, whatever you'd like to call it. And Peter took this particular job very, very seriously, and they dragged before them a number of very, very high profile stockbrokers, mining company directors and others, and created turned the committee into if not into a really major, significant force, and showed just how the Senate could actually get to the bottom of substantive issues by using its inquisitorial powers. Cormack became president of the Senate, and Ray then assumed the committee chairmanship, which he proceeded to come up with a report, which has been pretty much the basis of the formation of a national stock exchange, and a lot of company law changes have come about as a direct result of that committee's inquiries. And played my part. I reported that virtually from the day it was started right through until the finish, and became quite expert on it. And the interesting thing about it was that after a while, the Labor senators, including a guy called George Georges from Queensland, all became they all worked very, very cooperatively. The politics was put out of to one side, and it was probably the best exercise in the Senate committee system that has taken place since it started. Whereas today, unfortunately, and I feel quite disappointed about this, all too often the committees that get news tend to be politically, the politics shines through, it becomes quite obvious that they're political exercises. There are still some that do some very good work, come up with some very good reports, and they're never mentioned. But
All right, good. Thanks for that. Now, I wanted to ask about the atmosphere in the building here after November 11th. That was something that I didn't actually ask you about when we were talking about the dismissal. What was the atmosphere like after that happened?
Funnily enough, in the immediate short term, I think people were more concerned with getting on with the election than they were about anything else. I mean, there's certainly a lot of people from the Labor Party were understandably very, very bitter and annoyed, to put it mildly, angry about what had happened. But I don't think anyone really had the luxury of time to get for the atmosphere to change. It was just a case of one side became opposition, one side became government. I don't believe we even changed offices. It was a case of getting out into the electorate and running around yelling and screaming at poor innocent voters. So within the building, I don't recall any particular atmospheric change. Of course, after the election, things again. I think by that time, while the anger remained, and I think just people were so exhausted, and it was coming up to Christmas, that everything just sort of died down, quite frankly. So others may say it differently. I mean, there may well be. I'm quite sure those who were dismissed would have been still carrying considerable unhappiness, to put it mildly. But I can't say that I ever encountered any particular aggro, for want of a better word, from people on the other side. A funny thing about politics, you know, a lot of it is smoke and mirrors, and the people inside, whether they're on one side, one party or the other, will often tend to be quite pragmatic about who's winning and who's losing. And it's, I wouldn't say it's a game. Well, it is. In some respects, it's a game played very, very seriously. It's a bit like, you know, when you see tennis players who on the court are beating the daylights out of one another, and then if what you hear is true, and I don't know whether it is or not, but afterwards they'll go and have dinner together, or go and have a practice match together, or to help teach one another's kids how to play. And I guess in those days, I can't say what it's like today, but in those days I think the those involved in politics tended to have a sort of a shared mateship, because we're all in the same business. And some days you'd win, some days you'd lose, and it was the stakes were high, but the level of intensity, it's often said, and it is true, that as often as not, some of your best friends in politics are on the other side, and some of the worst enemies are on your own side. And in fact, I think that is a truism. I think there's more. There tends to be more resentment within a political party when things change, like leaders are changed or policies are rolled. There's more intense bitterness within the party than there is between parties. Because you sort of accept that the other side are out to do you, but you don't accept that people on your own side are going to do the same thing. So that creates that sort of, you know, really strong resentment, which it was been obvious with the Labor Party between in the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd years, which has still hung over, and I think even today within the coalition, I think the the pro-abbot and anti-abbot forces are probably quite. If it ever came to a head, as it probably will, the losing side will be quite bitter about those who've won. And that was the case when Fraser replaced Bill Snedden.
Yes.
A lot of the Liberals who supported Snedden were very, very unhappy about Fraser. If we talk about atmosphere, I think the atmosphere within the Parliamentary Liberal Party after for about a week after Fraser rolled Snedden was far more toxic than the general atmosphere within the building between Labor and Liberal people after the dismissal.
Go on.
Mm-hmm. And people like, for example, Grant Freudenberg, the incredibly marvellous speechwriter who is a Labor icon, and deservedly so, and I maintained we'd always been reasonably friendly. Graham was just a delightful person. I got on very well with him. And he, even while we were sort of throwing supply or holding up the appropriation bills, Graham and I continued to have quite a harmonious relationship, a friendly relationship, as we did with Ken Reitney's staff. So, what we see from outside isn't always what you see on the inside.
Ah, thanks. Yeah. I wanted to ask too about Senator Withers' office. Like, how did an office at that level work back then? What were sort of the daily routines in it and the hierarchy within it, you know, the different tasks, duties?
Yep. Well, the opposition office was much smaller. In opposition, we had no departmental backup. There was only Withers, his private secretary, myself, a research officer, and a typist. So that was about staff four. Withers himself, and so we had to really do all the sort of legwork and research work and so on. Interesting, I remember, I'm not sure whether I mentioned this or not, the office was, as most of the offices are, was filled with bookshelves that were full of Hansard. And one day, after we'd blocked the appropriations, I sat there for a full day going through Hansards because I had a vague memory of something Lionel Murphy had said. And in fact, Murphy had, I found the reference, Murphy had tabled a list of all the money bills that Labor had opposed in the Senate from about 1949 until the present day. And it was incredibly long. And Murphy made the point that if Labor could use the rejection of a money bill to force a government to the polls, that was its duty to do. And so we had great fun throwing that back at back at the Labor Party. But it tends to be forgotten, and the only difference was that Labor could very conveniently oppose appropriations or supply bills and stand up for whatever it was arguing, but it never had the numbers, so it had the luxury of maintaining a position without the odium of executing it. It's a bit different, and I think to myself today, one of the unfortunate things for Labor, as much as for anything else, is that they do have a capacity to get the numbers in the Senate, which means that rather than simply maintaining a strong stance, on an issue and voting against it, but still having the legislation go through, they now carry the responsibility that if they do oppose something, it actually does stop. Now, what does that mean? Well, if as they say, the government move is so obnoxious that they must stop it, it saves the people from ever being affected by that unpleasant piece of legislation. Yeah. So they sort of create problems for themselves, which don't quite exist if you don't have the numbers in the upper house.
But with the office, did the how many people were there, and what were the jobs assigned to them?
Well, in opposition once again, we would start off fairly early in the morning. My job was to go down with the other four press secretaries and a couple of people from the Liberal Party headquarters, and we would work through what was in the newspapers and what sort of questions might be asked that day, and we'd do that until question time started. Withers himself would there was usually a party meeting, although there was officially a party meeting on Wednesdays, there would usually be a party meeting before Parliament sat, just to sort of talk through tactics and what was going to be done. And we had a research officer whose job was to research, and it was very broadly defined. It was a case of anything that...